Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And good afternoon, Rochester. You are listening to Soundbites right here at member-supported Jazz 90.1. I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And Nick Francesco has taken a long and deserved hiatus for this day, kind of doing some family time stuff. So, hey, we are all entitled to it. And I want to remind you folks, you know the numbers, 966-5299 or toll-free 1-800-790-0415. If you have a computer question, we'd love to take them. And I see somebody already calling right now. If you hold on, we will get to you. It is just Nick, Steve and I right now in the studio. We might be joined later by somebody else. But if you do get on the phone and I'm not picking up right away, we are kind of doing it shorthanded here, because normally I can turn it over to both Nick and Steve. Now I got to dump just on Steve to fill in for a few moments.
Yeah, Nick is the professional voice actor and theater actor, actually knows how to fill time. And he's the one filling time while you're setting up the board, I'm setting up the Ustream. But we did have some interesting shakeups in corporate leadership this week. At Microsoft, Steven Sinofsky has left Microsoft. He has been a longtime corporate executive and has been credited with turning the company's franchise around and leading to the release of Windows 8, which a lot of people aren't going to like, we think. Microsoft said the decision behind Sinofsky's departure was mutual, although the abruptness of his resignation might lead some to consider otherwise. So it's been reports that Steve Ballmer and Steven Sinofsky have been sparring with each other over different aspects of Microsoft, and the fact that they're both named Steve could be a problem.
Yeah, really. Steve, what's in the name there?
Well, and how many big executives is the name Steve so common? We have Steve Jobs and Steve Ballmer and Steve Sinofsky. And yeah. Steve Case at AOL was huge. So,
other words, if you don't have the name Steve, don't apply for the job.
Right, and if you do have the name Steve, you can't get an email address anywhere because someone else has already got Steve at.
Oops.
Yeah. And then in Apple news, Scott Forstall is leaving Apple. He was the senior vice president of iOS design, I believe it was. And he's leaving sometime next year, but his executive duties have been dramatically reduced, and some people are saying it's because he didn't apologize over the iOS Maps issue. When Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, posted his apology over Maps, if you don't remember, in iOS 6, the new mapping program from Apple doesn't use the Google Map data anymore. They're using OpenStreetMaps and Garmin Map data, and a lot of people in more urban rural areas have noticed that the mapping data isn't as accurate. Tim Cook issued a formal apology on Apple's website, and the rumor is that Scott Forstall wouldn't apologize for it. So, you know, all these background, you know, executive shakeups and things are changing. It was also a few months ago announced that Bob Mansfield, who's the senior vice president of hardware, was going to retire. That has now, in essence, been reversed. He's not leaving. And so it looks like we're going to see Craig Federighi at Apple, who was the OS X software guy, taking over for iOS as well. And some of them are a little, some of us are a little concerned that that means more iOSification of Mac OS X. And we're seeing that in Windows now, that Windows 8 desktop and Windows 8 tablet are nearly identical. And we've been seeing that in the last couple of versions of Mac OS X, that it's looking more and more like iOS, but they're not forcing that look on you. You can choose to go into Launchpad, and you can choose to go into Mission Control. And the fear is that in some future version, they're going to force us into those options, just like Microsoft has done with Windows 8.
No, if they sit back and wait a little bit, I think they're going to be they're wise in that they're not doing that right now, given the option to switch, because I think ultimately that's what Microsoft is going to be forced to do.
Yeah, we're going to see a huge, we think we're going to see a huge backlash from enterprise and IT and corporate that Windows 8 is so different. They just got around to upgrading everyone to Windows 7.
In some cases,
that we are expecting a lot of companies just to skip Windows 8 and see how Windows 9 looks. Or Microsoft is going to come out and say, okay, you don't have to run the Metro interface. We'll let you run the old-style interface.
Well, that's where they shot themselves in the foot. I said that a few months ago when I was beta testing Windows 8, that, you know, not giving us the option. In the past, various versions of Windows, they did it very simplistically in that you could choose between the new menu look or the old menu look, whatever you were comfortable for. But to take folks from going from a desktop computer to all of a sudden now tablet look, to a lot of folks, that is totally speaking Greek. They don't have a clue on what they're supposed to do, and applets and everything else. I mean, they've been able to muddle their way when they had Windows XP to go to Windows 7. You know, because for the most part, yeah, they renamed some stuff and changed this and that, but they were minor. There were stuff folks could still deal with because the start button was still there, and they could still get to the programs and install stuff. But now to all of a sudden have this where I'm swishing and going from screen to screen, I'm not going to want to do that with a stupid mouse.
Well, and Apple does that on OS X with their Magic Trackpad. Basically, it's the trackpad that's been common on laptops. You now get as an external option for your Mac. And you can do those multi-touch gestures and multi-touch swiping. But you don't have to, which is still important. In fact, even their Magic Mouse, it has no physical buttons on it. The whole surface of a mouse is a sensor. So you have left and right click, and you have swipe left and right if you want to use it, but you don't have to. Right. And that's the big difference. On Windows 8, you're being forced to go into that.
Well, that's the other thing, too. They show their commercials, like we were talking before we went on there, about that big tablet, and they set it in front of the young lady, and she's doing these paintings.
Yep.
All right, that's cool if you're an artist. But what the heck, if I'm typing and I want to do up a letter, or which is the real world, you know, email and all that other stuff, they don't show that. I mean, they show cool commercials, you know, people hooking up a keyboard to their tablet.
Yeah.
Again, it's a tablet.
Which is the irony. On their desktop commercials, they're showing tablets. And on their tablet commercials, they're showing, in essence, a desktop.
Yeah. And again,
though, a computer with a screen,
but again, you're still using your finger to swipe across, and then you maybe using that little attachable keyboard.
Yeah,
but still, not majority of the actions are all swipe.
What's interesting is that we see a lot of users who are switching between tablet and laptop. We're so used to swiping on our tablet that even I've done it myself. I'll forget for a second to try to swipe on my laptop. Yeah,
and our phones.
It's on your phones and your tablet, and then so your laptop should do that too. Eventually, we'll start seeing more and more laptops, I'm guessing, with touch-sensitive screens, but the cost has been so high.
Yeah, but
now,
who wants to keep reaching over their desk to sit
there? Don't force us to do that.
Yeah.
Give us the keyboard, give us the mouse, but swiping if we want to. We see that in point-of-sale cash registers, where it's a touch screen, and you just touch on the thing that people are buying. In fact, we used to joke about that in older shows. Years ago, when some of the big fast food chains went to touchscreen registers, because you just touch the picture of the hamburger they want, you don't have to know anything about it. So it's and is that the dumbing down of America too?
Oh, well, it definitely is, because I mean, you can, like I give say somebody, the item is $5 and 40 cents, and you give them a 10 and 40 cents, and they go, wait a minute, this is too much change.
Or what's even worse,
I want a $5 back. I don't want the change in all the ones.
I'll give them 3 pennies to get back an even quarter, and they just stare at it.
Yeah.
Which is, I find it especially silly, because you just type the amount tendered into the computer, and it tells you the change. Yeah.
But it's blown away, because a lot of the kids, don't know how to do math.
Well, I've even started seeing more cash registers now that have the automatic change thing. So you hand over a 20, they push the button that says 20, and the change spits out the chute on you.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of those all the time when I was a kid, and now they're starting to come back.
Well, the same with going through even, you know, the grocery stores and the self-service centers, you know, that you can scan all the stuff, you put your credit card in there, or, you know, the amount that you want to put in, whether it's a 20 or whatever, and it gives you the appropriate change back. And again, it takes out the whole interface of interfacing with the clientele.
And sometimes if I'm in a hurry, and I always see that person with 15 items in the 14 lane, and I get annoyed by that. And you know, I just have one thing I need to buy. I really like those self-checkout lanes.
Here's the question, though. If something's 2 for $1,
right? Does that count
as one, or is that two items?
Right. Is a dozen eggs one item or a dozen?
Yeah.
In fact, I was joking with a cashier the other day. I actually had 9 items, but the 7 item lane was empty. And so she said, "Oh, come on, it's okay." But I had what did I have? I had like 2 boxes of cereal. So how many pieces of cereal are in each box? a dozen eggs. Is that a dozen or one?
Exactly. And or if you got something like, say, some cranberries, and they got a 2 for $1, you know, price.
Yep.
Now, is that technically 2 items or 1 item?
Yeah.
It's a conundrum. Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to go to the phones in a minute, but I want to remind you folks, pick up the phones and give us a call, 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415, or you can also text us. We have it up on the screen at 585-209-9010, and we'll go to the phones, and we got Linda on the phone.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Great. How you doing?
Good. I bought my computer over. I hear you semi-retired.
Yes, I have.
I'm not going to say where you work. I know, but I'm not going to say it.
No, that's okay. No.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I've already run in.
I got an early Christmas present. I got the Nexus 7 with 32 gigs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Question on Gmail. I went in on my laptop to Gmail. I've got duplicate folders. It says, you know, remove them. But then it said click save. I couldn't find the save button to save my life on that thing. Once you remove it, it says click save. Where is the save button on Gmail?
You probably have to scroll down because the 7-inch screen is too small to show
down,
it.
I went left, I went right, find it.
What are you trying to save?
Okay, on Gmail, I've got duplicate folders.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to remove some of the duplicate folders that had nothing in them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I removed the folders. And then I went to click out of it, and it says, you did not save this. And I said, okay. So I went back. There's supposed to be a save button to save all the changes. I couldn't find it.
Yeah, I'm logging into my Google account now to see if I can find where it is.
Yeah, I did everything I wanted to do, but it says, please click the save button. I couldn't find it. I went into settings, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, if you go up to file...
It's got to be in the window itself, because you're making changes in the window. There's usually save or cancel, usually at the bottom of the window you're in.
Yeah.
And I've seen sometimes on tablets that are too small.
That if it's down off the screen and you can't get at it. Yeah.
Now, one thing we have seen on, I find on my iPad a lot, some websites aren't necessarily designed for tablets. And so you can scroll the window typically with one finger swiping up and down. But sometimes there's a list in the window.
Yeah.
And so if you use one finger, it scrolls the whole window. You may have to use 2 fingers to scroll the list in the window.
I was doing this on my laptop, not on my iPad, because I figured, well, my laptop, I can get into Gmail. So I thought to myself, okay, I'll go in my computer.
Yeah. I'm in settings now, and at the very bottom of the list, there's a save changes button and a cancel button.
Huh.
All the way down at the very bottom. I had to scroll down twice.
Very bottom. What's the left or the right side?
It's right in the center.
Right in the center. Because I scroll all the way down and I couldn't find it.
Well, sometimes just log out and log back in and it fixes itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I tried to log out. It says, you have not clicked the save button. It wouldn't let me, you know. And I thought to myself, okay.
Uh-huh.
Because when I went from Windows, when I went from Yahoo to transferring everything to Gmail, I got duplicate folders. So it says underneath there are 0 things in this file. I went, okay. So I, you know, deleted it. But then it says click the save button. And I tried for 20 minutes looking for that stupid save button. I couldn't find it.
Oh, boy.
So So anyway,
yep, just close the window, log out, and try logging back in.
Yeah. So Dave, how do you like your Nexus 7?
He's really liking his Nexus 7. He picked one up after Nick talked about it.
Oh, yes. No, I've got one. Matter of fact, I take it to work with me. And for the folks, without mentioning names, let's just put it this way. I wear an orange apron. And
I know where you are.
And, I'm having a lot of fun there. So, Nick would be.
Forgot to put it. Got dance music on your phone there.
Oh, it's a default. You know, I get in the habit of forgetting to quick switch it over, and it's like, oops.
Yeah.
But
my computer, and I told Sam, I said, "Where's Dave?" She goes, "Oh, he's got another job." I go, "Wow."
Well, yeah.
Anyway, so my
after 50 years in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, I'm as folks know, and this is not to get too somber or anything else. I started the business many years ago with my lovely wife, who had passed away now a couple years ago.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Lori passed away a little over 2 years ago.
Wow.
And her and I started the business.
Yeah, I remember that, because I remember I used to talk to Lori a lot when I would call. Sometimes she'd answer the phone. He had a very nice wife.
Yeah, thank you very much. But yes, I'm 64 years old, and I wanted to do something a little different. You'll still find me down in the shop when I'm not working in the other place, because I still love keeping up with the technology, and it's a lot of fun, and still down there bugging Sam and doing the stuff. So like you say, it is semi-retired, but I also like this other career. It's just something different for me in my life.
And she tells me she's going to school to learn the business.
Yes, she is. She is.
I was there a couple of days ago, and I brought my computer in, and she says to me, "Dave is semi-retired." I go, "It's about time."
Yeah, it is. I'm loving it. I've got a great group of folks that I work with and having fun, and that's what life's all about.
At our age, you got to have fun.
Well, that was the whole thing when I started the computer business. Lori and I started it, and it was one of these things that when I got up in the morning, I looked forward to going to work, and I still do. Having the business right there in my house, it's a lot of fun. I still get to meet a lot of great people, and that's the cool thing about it. And with our business here in the computer world, as folks know, things never stay the same. And I know Steve can attest to this, too. It's always changing.
Yeah. Yep,
there's always something new to learn.
Which is always
annoying, and we have to learn it first so we can tell people how to do it themselves.
Okay, well, have a nice Thanksgiving, guys.
You too, Linda.
Okay, see you later. Bye.
Okay. All right, and with that, we're going to take a short break here and thank our underwriters, and we'll be right back with Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer Talk.
And welcome back to this edition of Soundbites. I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And Nick Francesco is taking a well-deserved day off. I don't even think he had a day off this year. I know he took one. Oh, no, I take that back. Yes, he did take one day off to go get his daughter at college. And that was during the summer months when she had to come home.
Yep.
So,
so coming up on a holiday weekend. Too.
Yeah.
We started seeing a lot of Black Friday ads.
Where did the month of November go? I mean, it just seems like we just got through with Halloween, and now all of a sudden, bam.
The Christmas decorations went up in September. Like right after Labor Day, stores started putting Christmas stuff up.
Yeah, they got me. You go into a Rite Aid or one of the other drugstores and all that other stuff and see the Christmas wrapping paper out and all this. It's like, you know what? I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm old-fashioned, and I'll admit it. I still like the day. Oh, matter of fact, a friend of mine sent me a link to the store, and they have an advertisement up. We will not, nor will we ever, start doing Christmas until after Thanksgiving.
Yep. Some of the other radio stations in town have said, we won't play Christmas music at least until December. Because there's one that already has started.
And I'm sorry. I am old-fashioned. I remember as a kid, you watched the Macy's Day Parade on Thanksgiving.
Yep.
And when Santa Claus came down, which he was always the last thing, that officially started Thanksgiving. And even in downtown Rochester, all of a sudden the lights would come on yep. and light the whole street, and Sibley's and McCurdy's and Woolworth's and JCPenney's and all them downtown. It just lit right on up. Yep. And the window displays were something else. And I still enjoy those times. We've just gotten so damn commercial.
Yeah.
You know, and pushing the holiday, it takes the fun out of it for me.
Yep. Well, but then, you know, I'll put my other hat on as someone yep. who has a retail store. They call it Black Friday because that's where you hope to make up your year's profits. Because you're working in the red most of the year. And that's why a lot of companies have Christmas be their first quarter.
All right. And here, talking about that, and again, you know, now that I'm in to retail, another aspect of it. One of the other things that bothers me, you know, it's granted they have all these Black Friday sales, you know, because folks want to get the deals on the computers and all this other stuff. But there's one big chain store that I won't mention that's opening up early, or I should say late.
On
Thanksgiving Day.
Yep.
Hello. To me, that is being very inconsiderate. And what do I mean by that? The poor folks that have to go into that store. So if you got nothing better to do and you're full of turkey and you go into the store so you can get these deals, you can't wait until the next day. You got to have it on a holiday. I'm sorry. That is just too damn much. Yeah. I'm sorry.
At least I hope they're asking
people. And those are my opinions and do not reflect the opinions of this station or anybody else.
At least I'm hoping at least they're asking people to volunteer and not forcing people to work. But yeah, that's an annoying one. And then for people that want to get the good deals, you know, I don't want to get up at 3 a.m. to go get the good deal. In fact, I got, you know, my wife got a pre-Black Friday sale offer. There's a store that has a 50-inch LCD television for $350. And that sounds like a good deal. But it's only available at like 4 a.m. and I bet the store only has one of them. So the biggest and best of those deals are always out of stock by the time you get there. So it's very annoying.
Yep. Tell you what, let's go to the phone. We've got Tim from Rochester.
Yes. Hi, guys. Perfect segue. My question here would be about I want to get a tablet for someone for Christmas, and they're in a nearby room, so forgive me for being kind of quiet. And I really don't know much of anything about them. I'm more of a laptop guy, so if you guys could just give me some basic information to help steer me towards my...
There's three major tablet OSs.
And sizes. Well, and size is going to be, you know, whether you want a small hand tablet, like I've got the Nexus 7, which is a 7-inch tablet. You can go to 10-inch tablets. You can go to even bigger, 12-inch.
Some bigger ones, yeah. But the three basic platforms are basically Amazon, Google, and Apple.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a lot depends on where you get your content from, because the big thing of a tablet is getting content. They all do mail, they all do web, stuff like that. But if you buy a lot of Amazon movies or Amazon MP3s, then the Kindle series is probably good. If you buy a lot of stuff from the Google Play Store, then the Android tablets mm-hmm. are good. If you buy a lot of stuff from the Apple Store, then the iPad tablets are probably best. The one thing that I personally like about the iPads is they do allow you to get into the Google stores and the Amazon stores. So you can get to the bookstores and music stores from the iPad on the other devices. It's a little tricky to get to, say, the Google store on an Android or on a Amazon OS. But conversely, you cannot get to any of the Apple stores on the non-Apple devices. So a lot depends on what other devices you have in your house, and then what stores you want to get into to buy your content. But as Dave said, the 7 and 8 inch tablets are usually in the 200 to 300 range. The 10 inch tablets are usually in the 400 to 500 range, and then you can move up from there as well.
And what you want to do with it too, you know, you're gonna individual needs. Whether you want to just have it, you know, in sizes. And
yeah, if you're just looking for a book reader, then the $79 Kindle is great.
Yeah.
What do people mostly use them for then?
Yes.
Everything. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Mail, any from doing mail, simple web. Mail, web.
Video, games.
I mean, I've got the 8 gig Nexus, and I love my books on it. I've got my books, so whether I'm home or wherever, you know, I can have that with me, quick pull it out. The battery life on it is unbelievable in standby. I can still surf the net. I've got my Google Drive on it, so if I've got any documents I want to pull up or look, yep. I can get to the Google Drive and do that. Yep. I can still do Facebook. I can surf the web, anything.
So okay. For accessing Wi-Fi with these, what are the browsers that are being used?
I'm using Foxfire.
Oh,
on the tablet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the tablets come with their own browsers.
Right, Google.
The Android tablets have Chrome. The Amazon tablet is I forget what the name of theirs is, but the Amazon tablet is based on Android, but Amazon puts their stuff on the top of it, and then the Apple tablet comes with Safari. But right. On most of the tablets, you can get Chrome or Firefox or some of the other browsers as well. So okay. That's so the web browsing is sort of one of the standard features on the tablets. One of the things I like about my iPad too is that, in addition to, you know, all the games and Angry Birds and stuff like that, there are real work programs available for it. I use a program called FileMaker, which is a database application environment, and I can connect into my database back at the office and do work. I do when I'm doing remote service calls, I can access all of our corporate information back at the office, and so that's a real big advantage for me because we use FileMaker in our office as well.
What would be the main reason then why people would choose these over a small laptop?
Again, portability. I mean, my Nexus tablet, I can throw in my back pocket.
Yeah.
It's very thin. You can fit it easily in a backpack or anything else. The weight on them is nominal.
Yeah, the class of a laptop called netbook has pretty well gone away with tablets. So, but now the PC manufacturers are pushing their ultrabooks. So you can get a 2 to 3 pound laptop in the 11-inch or 13-inch line, but that's still, you know, 2 to 3 times the weight of a 1 pound tablet.
And the other thing too is battery life. I mean,
yeah.
You know, life on a laptop or, you know, compared to a tablet can be significant.
A lot of the ultrabooks are using solid state drives instead of spinning mechanical hard drives to help increase the battery life.
Oh, yes. You know what? I was looking at, I think, one of those in the past couple weeks, and they were telling me that the battery is built in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most Ultrabooks have a built-in battery yeah. as well. Apple explained it when they did that in their MacBook Air line, is saying that they, by removing the mechanism for having a removable battery, they can make the battery bigger and therefore give you more battery life. So it's become most devices now have a non-user replaceable battery, so that becomes a service part to replace the battery. But most of these batteries now we're seeing with the big lithium-ion batteries, they're good for 1,000 recharge cycles, which is 4 to 5 years of average use.
Yeah.
And so before you need to replace the battery, you've already replaced the tablet itself, and then it's someone else's problem.
Mm-hmm.
Never underestimate the someone else's problem field.
Well, okay, this is great. This gives me a great head start then. I want to let you guys know I am a member. I love the Jazz, and I love what you guys are doing. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Okay. Appreciate it.
Have a happy holiday.
You too, sir, and have a safe one.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
And that's one nice thing about going into the stores before the holiday madness is that mm-hmm. the crowds are lower, and you can take yeah. your time, and you'll probably get to talk to a salesperson a little better.
But you know what? The thing of it is, so as a matter of fact, I was talking to Al and them on the Polka guys, talking about it. You know, you go all these sales on Black Friday.
Yep.
The real good time to go and get sales is usually a couple weeks after.
Yep.
Because if they didn't meet their expectations, quite often places will even have bigger sales because they're even trying to squeeze that extra dollar out of you, so they'll drop it yep. more. Quite often, that's when I'll go clothes shopping.
Yeah,
I've gotten in the habit of going shopping, you know, like 2 weeks before Christmas because they drop all the prices, and you can get some good deals. And you know, just got to look around. But you know, I'm definitely one of these idiots that's going to be out. Well, I shouldn't say this. I have never in my life been out on a Black Friday. This is the first time in 64 years.
Yep.
My butt's going to be up and working at 6 o'clock in the morning. But there's no way.
A home improvement store you wouldn't think about as a Black Friday deal, but you guys sell appliances and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, our Christmas display in it. You know, mm-hmm. It's unbelievable.
I love the big blow-up Christmas stuff in the front.
Oh, they got this other mouse now. He plays different tunes, and it's really cute. And you know what else is getting really popular? And it started back, again, with computers, was that you can get all these lights now and sync it up so that it plays to a tune outside.
Yep.
You know, remember the Trans-Siberian Orchestra? And that guy had the Wizard of Winter playing the... and the lights all over the house, and it was inundated YouTube.
Yep.
It was the most hits, and you know now it's so popular all over the place that you can go and see that, and a lot of places are starting to do it. I know around here in Rochester, there's a number of places that you can... they set up quite a display. And I think it's a place over in Gates. There's a few streets there that they have it's almost like they have competitions because they light up all these houses and they have kids outside and they're selling popcorn and hot cider and all this. And you ride around and see all the fantastic lights and the displays. That part of it I really do enjoy. And you know,
unless you're the Jewish family on the block. Okay. And then you've got your menorah.
Yeah, hey, that's fine. Yep. Or Kwanzaa or whatever. Yep. You know, hey, equal opportunist, and we celebrate them all.
Well, Christmas has become so commercial anymore; it's pretty much lost any of its religious significance.
You know, that's one thing maybe we should do as it gets, and we won't do it until after December 22nd. Is start getting a list together we have up on our website that folks can email us. When they see, you know, a real good display, and we could compile a list of great sites. Because I love, you know, I've taken my grandchildren out on an evening and just go on and ride around and see the different holiday lights.
Yep.
That's a lot of fun, you know, for an evening and that. All right, do we have any other, we had some other emails there, I know.
We had a question come in. You can get questions answered by going to our website at soundbites.org. They have been a listener for years and years and years. The current work schedule prevents them from listening to the live show, so they rely on the podcasts. And they've had a problem with Android downloading the podcasts, which is interesting, because... Nick uses an Android device. So
and I do, too. And, in fact, they just came out with a new Android 4.2. And who was it? Orchard Park texted me, asked me how I like it, and I love it.
Yep. He says he can download the MP3 directly from the website, but as a podcast subscription, it isn't working. And so he's not quite sure what to do. We'll have Nick check the code for that podcast. It should work. iTunes is hosting the podcast code from iTunes if you mm-hmm. subscribe there. And then
wouldn't it be the better way to do it? Let's go through the iTunes.
Well, you can't do that on Android.
Oh, that's
right. There's no iTunes app on Android. Yeah,
Catch 22.
But it should be just a standard, XML podcast file. Mm-hmm. But there may be something that we've got in the code to make it work better on iTunes. That's giving it a problem on Android. So we'll have Nick look into that code. And then his second question is, he has been listening since the early days when we were on three stations ago. User of Quattro Pro versus Lotus 1-2-3. And we've had a couple of questions in the forums about any copies of those old radio shows. We started recording the show ourselves December 2001. And so that's as far back as our local podcasts go. So that's only 11 years, sorry.
11 out of 24.
Out of 20, yeah. When we were on that first station so long ago, no one ever thought about recording it. But we have heard that some of our listeners back then did record a few episodes.
I used to, for the longest time, remember, I used to do the tapes.
Yep.
And I had
actual magnetic tape.
Yes, I had the cassette tapes, and I had tons of them, but...
So if anyone has any of those old shows or tapes, they can digitize, and it'd be really neat to put them up into the archives to see what we were talking about 15, 20 years ago. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, which is interesting because, you know, we're coming up on our just past our 23rd birthday last month. Yep.
All right.
Yeah, go. Okay. So, yeah, so the music says we're going to take another quick break, and we'll be right back with more of your questions on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And welcome back to this edition of Sounds and Bites. I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And want to remind you folks, you can give us a call with your computer questions at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Or, of course, you can text us at 585-209-9010. Just like our friends out in Orchard Park threw me a text there and said, asked how I liked the Android 4.2, which is, just came out.
Which is also Jelly Bean.
Yep. And I
they didn't make a new name for it.
Yeah. I updated. Well, it's only a revision, so.
Well, the rest of them, every part has had a new name.
Oh, well. But they're probably getting smart, you know. If it's a minor one, like a point something, keep it the same.
And don't run out of names too long or too quick. Exactly. Apple's running into that now. We're at 10.8, and people have started seeing 10.9 rumors. Mm-hmm. Are they going to do a 10.10 and 10.11, or are we going to go to 11 point?
Yeah, when does the point stop?
Yeah.
But, so you can, also text us. We have that set up and right here in the studio, so we can answer your questions there. If you happen to be out and about and don't have your computer handy, but you are, listening to us with our applet from Jazz 90.1, the Jazz 90.1 applet, you can still stay in touch.
And as Dave goes to answer the phone, let's take a quick offline question here that came into our website at soundbites.org. Shirley is having a problem that the icons on her homepage keep changing. Every time she turns the computer on in the morning, the icons are really big. So she right-clicks on the desktop to make them small. And if she reboots, they go back to large again. And she wants to keep them small. One of the things we've seen now and then in issues like that is that after you make a change to the icon size or make a change to the positions on your desktop, hit the, the F5 key, is it? To save the changes you've made to the icons on your desktop. And so F5 is supposed to tell it to save those changes so that it will keep those changes next time you reboot.
Right. And if you got the icons on it, you can usually do a control minus.
Control plus, control minus. On the Mac, it's command plus, command minus. Make things bigger, smaller.
All right, tell you what, we got Joe from Greece on the phone.
Yes, I wonder if you can help me out. I just acquired for free an old computer with Vista. I'm running XP. Is there any benefits to hooking that old computer up to mine as a slave? And if so, what's the easiest way to do it?
What do you mean by hooking it up as a slave?
Well, they use it in conjunction so I have better capacity.
You might as well just get an external hard drive.
Well, better capacity doesn't really do anything. You have two separate computers, and they're both separate.
Yeah.
So there's no benefit.
Not really.
You
can share. Well, you can share your hard drive between the computers, but that's usually only if you want to get files from one computer onto the other computer.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and still using the processor or anything else versus having an external storage space.
Yeah. Okay. There are some specific programs, video rendering programs are common, something like Final Cut and Premiere, where you can install the same program on multiple computers, and when it's rendering your video effects, it can distribute that processor load.
Okay.
But that's, it's a very specialized industry.
Well, that's where I've also seen folks, if they do have two computers like that, use one for strictly, surfing the internet and everything else, and if it gets mucked up, oh well, no biggie. And then keep their work stuff and other important stuff like photos and everything else that they do on the other one and don't go on the internet with it. And, keep everything pristine over there.
Okay, what's a good way to get rid of that old computer?
What do you mean get rid of it?
Well, if I can't use it, then I might as well get rid of it.
There are some recycling companies in town. Technically, computers are full of hazardous material, cadmium and lead and whatnot.
We dispose of them.
So you can't just put them in the garbage. Although, if you set them up by the road, it'll disappear in an hour.
Right, and if it's got any important information on there, we wipe all that stuff off, and I love taking the hard drives out. And if they're no good or too small, I turn the hard drives into maracas, Or, you know, or I can find homes for them. You clean them up, and, you know, I've got other places that can use a computer, you know, agencies that doesn't need the high-end stuff.
Yeah. So you can use a program called Derek's Boot and Nuke, DBAN, dban.org. You can download that, and it will wipe all the data from your drive so that no one else can get it back. Or some people, if they're used to it and able to do it, just take the hard drive out of the computer before you get rid of it. But there are a couple of commercial recycling centers in town as well. If you go to ewaste.org, I think it is, that will list a couple of them. I know the big one is Regional Computer Recycling. They have offices downtown and in Victor. But then also check with your town. What town do you live in again?
Greece.
I don't know offhand if Greece does. A lot of the towns will take their own... have their own electronics recycling program at the main town waste management facility that we used to call the dump. But yeah, quite often the towns do have things like that. And at ewaste.com, they do have a list of all the residential areas that will do that for themselves as well.
Very good. Thank you very much. God bless you for your fine service you can do to the community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So electronic waste is a big issue because you don't want it ending up in landfills. You don't want the hazardous material running off into the water table. So the electronic recycling and green recycling these days, they break components down, separate them out. You can recycle the metals. You can recycle the plastic. So many computers are plastic these days. You can melt it down or chip it up into blocks and reuse it.
Yep.
So you want to make sure that you find an environmentally conscious recycling company.
Yeah, exactly. All right, tell you what, let's go back to the phones. We've got Victor from Irondequoit. Go ahead, Victor.
Hi, guys. Am I correct in assuming that if you're a hacker and you're trying to hack into somebody's bank account, you're using some type of a computer program, correct? Not just trial and error?
Sometimes it is trial and error. A lot of times you can go to the password recovery program. So if I want to get into your Citibank account, I go to joe@gmail.com. It's probably somebody's address, and say, forgot my password. And then Citibank says, okay, who was your favorite school teacher? And a lot of those times, those types of security questions can be easily guessed or looked up online. There was a big issue with Sarah Palin a couple of years ago that someone broke into her email account by guessing her security answers. But the bigger thing we've been seeing lately is just social engineering. The Matt Honan break-in a few months ago, a guy called up Apple and said, hi, I'm Matt Honan. I can't remember my password. Send me a new one. And he was able to socially engineer them into sending him a new password.
Well, what I'm curious is, I have to make out a new password for my investments now every 6 months. Now, if I use quite a few uppercase of symbols versus not using them, is it that much harder for someone to hack into my account, or does it make any difference?
It can greatly increase the time required.
Yep.
You basically what's called increasing your alphabet. You don't want to use a single word. We sort of want to stop saying password anymore and use passphrase, because one of the ways that's called brute force attacking is you just feed a dictionary into the password field. So if you use two or three words, put a couple of capitals here and there,
or exclamation marks,
right, or say an at symbol instead of an A. But even that is known these days, so that's often used.
But you want to use a combination of letters and numbers and punctuation.
And you want it to be long.
Yes.
People always say they can't remember their passwords.
Minimum eight.
Even longer is better. So say you make your password, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Yeah.
That's very easy for you to remember, and it's extremely long and very difficult for brute force attacks.
What's that site that you can put in?
Yeah, there's
a test your...
The Gibson Research Company, grc.com, they have a website called Password Haystacks, grc.com/haystack. And he shows the math involved in these brute force attacking on how many characters your password is. So if, say, your password is password, and that tends to be a very common password anytime things get leaked out, that can be cracked in about 2 seconds with a typical password dictionary. Although if someone's just randomly typing passwords in, they're going to try something like password or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is the very first time. But you can actually watch the math increase if I use an at symbol instead of the A and say a 0 instead of the O. Now that's only going to take an hour. to break into.
So, is there a link on the site?
It's grc.com/haystack.htm.
And we'll have a link up there on our website.
Yep, it's we have links on our website also. And so it shows that basically a longer password is better. In fact, one of the things that they recommend even is password padding. So, you know, you can have an 8 or 9 character password, but then put in 8 periods. So now you have a 16 character password, and it will take 6 trillion centuries to break.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah. Or they could guess right the first try.
Okay,
but
well,
probably not.
I'm not doing now, but you gave me all kinds of different hints, and I'm going to try to use a combination of all of those and try to get a password that I can remember.
Well, that's the here's the other thing that I would say. You know, and you were talking about how they'll ask you the high school that you went to.
Yeah, lie.
Yeah, and say Brown Street. Or purple.
Yeah.
You know, something totally opposite of what you would expect of high school. You know, like a high school name. And, you know, again...
Because someone could look you up on LinkedIn or Facebook and find what high school you went to.
Yeah, and go chocolate cookies. You know, I mean, something totally obscure from the answer. It doesn't care. It's not going to sit there if you ask your first pet's name.
Purple.
Or Mrs. Brown's math class.
Yeah.
They don't care, you know.
It just checks to see if your answer matches what you typed in the first time.
Exactly, and it doesn't, you know, mean a hill of beans.
And the password reset questions are one of those points of vulnerability that people can look up and guess.
Yeah, and like you say, especially, what was that one site? Oh, I think it was a couple of years ago, that there was more personal information out there, you know, on your house and your income and everything
else. Yeah, all the things that are public record, you know, if you pay taxes, that's public record. If you bought a house, the address is public record. So all of this stuff is public record, and you used to have to go down to a courthouse to find this information. But there's websites now that make it very easy to find that stuff, sometimes, you know, for a fee, but it's very easy to find what we used to consider private information that's in the public record.
It's scary.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You gave me a lot of good tips, and now I've got to do my new password.
Well, that's what we're here for. Yep.
Thank you very much, guys.
You have a safe and great holiday.
You too, Dave.
Yep. One of the things that I like to say, and we've talked about in the past, to make it a little easier to remember your passwords, is you should have a different password for every service you use.
Yes.
Because you don't want someone guessing your Gmail password and then getting into your Citibank account. But that's hard for people to do, and people tend to use the same passwords everywhere. But think of a password. You know, we've talked in the past about, you know, two words separated by number. Happy 34 Monkey was our famous example.
Yes.
So when you make your Citibank password, do Happy 34 Monkey Citibank. And when you make your Amazon password, do Happy 34 Monkey Amazon. And so you know the pattern you used. And then you have to hope people don't guess that pattern.
Especially if you have a happy, you know, a phrase like that. Again, you can fill it in for a lot of different questions and replies for passwords that nobody else, like you say, would even guess.
Yeah.
And the more obscure that it is, the safer you are going to be.
Yep. And then in the Matt Honan example we talked about, they found his address by looking up his domain registry, and they got an address, and they got an email address out of that. And then they were able to call up Amazon and say, hi, I want to add a new credit card to my account, and here's my address. And Amazon did. So Amazon has since closed that loophole.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were able to call up Apple and say, I forgot my password. Here's my address, and here's my credit card that they just added to the Amazon account. And Apple gave them the password, and Apple is cutting down on that too. See, the problem is there's no way for them to know if it is someone who really did forget their password or it's someone lying and saying they forgot their password.
Right.
And for the vast majority of people, you know, average people, they have to be able to have that simple enough that, you know, I forgot my password, I don't remember my security questions, or I never set up security questions to begin with. They have to be able to have that customer service to let them back into their account. So they'll ask you things, you know, like your address that you've got on your credit card bill. But that's probably your home address that you can get out of the phone book. So it's very difficult to hide that social hacking issue. We've always talked about, you know, you don't have to break into somebody's password. Oftentimes you call them up and, you know, hi, this is Citibank tech support. We need your password so we can do some maintenance on your account. And a lot of times people will give it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they will. Well,
yeah, all right. That music tells us we got the top of the hour coming up, and we'll have some interesting dramas from our underwriters. And remember to give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Here on Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And good afternoon, folks. You are listening now to the second hour of Soundbites here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1. I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And Nick Francesco will be back. We've had a few folks questioning. He will be back next week to join us and kind of top off. You know, that's usually the week we're letting you know, because it's usually Black Friday and Cyber Monday.
Although Cyber Monday is kind of on a downtrend, because it used to be that people would wait until Monday when they got back to their office and their work that has the high-speed internet to do all their online shopping. But now so many people have broadband internet at home anyway, it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah. All right, tell you what, let's go back to the phones. We got Chuck from Irondequoit. How can we help you, Chuck?
Hey, Dave. I was sitting here surfing the net and listening to you. And all of a sudden, my computer froze up, and I did a restart, and I got a message, which I hope I'm wrong. It says, diskette drive zero seek failure. Is that a disk, hard drive failure?
Does it say diskette or disk?
Diskette.
Do you have a floppy in the hard drive? Floppy drive?
No.
Because diskette is usually the floppy drive. Yeah. Disk is the hard drive.
I don't know. I don't. The floppy drive hasn't worked in years.
Right.
Well, hasn't worked, or is there a floppy disk drive?
No, there's no floppy disk in it.
But there is a drive.
A couple of years ago, I started putting disk in there, and keep on telling me it wasn't formatted.
Okay. But the drive is still in the computer?
Yeah.
I would unplug the drive from the computer and then go into BIOS and say there's no floppy drive.
Yeah.
It may still be trying to read that floppy disk.
Yeah, all you got to do is turn the power off to it. You know, all you got to do is
pull the plug down.
Yeah, on the
Although sometimes I've seen the BIOS will give you a BIOS error because it can't find the floppy it thinks is there.
Yeah, just unhook the cable and the power. Of course, turn the machine off.
Right.
I have to tell folks that because I did have one mental midget try to do this with the power on. We won't go there. That's a whole nother Uncle Dave story that I did a long time ago. But you turn it off, leave it plugged in, because then that way you're grounded. Take the side panel off and unhook the cable and power supply to the floppy drive. Start it back up. You hit the delete key to go into the BIOS.
Or F2 or whatever BIOS key is.
Yep. F1. You go into it. The very first screen is usually the system setup, is where you can say that there is no floppy.
You'll probably get an error message in BIOS saying hardware has changed. Do you want to go into BIOS?
Yeah, it'll automatically
say yes.
Yeah, prompt you to go into that.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Now, if you go ahead and do that and disable the floppy and make sure that it's, you know, you can also look in the BIOS while you're in there to boot sequence.
Right.
Make sure the boot sequence is your hard drive.
Right.
And make sure that's okay. And if it is, just go ahead and save your settings, get out, reboot the machine. Now, if you still get that order, that error message, unfortunately, you might be visiting us.
Yeah. In general, the default boot order has been the floppy drive first. So if you stick a disk in, it boots there.
Right.
And then the hard drive second. So it may be that your computer is trying to read a disk that isn't there, and that's also a seek failure because there's no disk there.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much. Let me give that a try.
Give it a shot and let us know.
Okay, great. Bye.
And then hopefully he has a backup. So if it is his main hard drive, then he's got all his data saved.
You know, that's one thing folks should put on their list.
Yeah, good thing for your Christmas list, the backup drive.
Even just a simple thumb drive. I mean, you can get 32 gig thumb drives now, very reasonable.
Yep. It used to be if all you were saving is like Word files, and those are tiny.
Or burn them to DVD. Yep.
But now, so many people use their computers for digital photos.
Hmm.
You might have hundreds of megabytes in a single photo if you have a nice high-res camera.
Yep.
So you can easily get... I was just working with a customer's drive yesterday. She had 11 gigabytes of photos. And then another 10 gigabytes of music. So, yeah, you could put those on a thumb drive. But get yourself a nice 1 terabyte hard drive for less than $100.
Yeah.
And most of them come with their own backup programs.
I mean, music, granted, it's costly. But you know what? If I lost it, I wouldn't be upset. I can always get more music.
How much?
It's those pictures.
Yeah, the pictures you can.
The pictures. You know,
back.
If you've got old pictures of your grandparents or whatever that mean the world to you and be very upset. If you lost them, the same with documents. If you know, you've been working on a thesis or this particular document, that, and you know, it's very important that you have those, back those up. Like I say, music, there is a cost.
I heard an interesting thing about music is that, if you lose the music you've ripped, you can just re-rip your CDs. Or with most services, you can re-download them again. But how much is your time worth? You know, so say you have 1,000 CDs that you ripped, and you know, say a minute or two a piece. That's a lot of time that you might be wasting to to rip those back in. And how much is your time worth?
Yep.
And so, you know, $100 for a backup drive is very
and
reasonable.
It's ridiculous. You know, like you say, a terabyte.
Yep. And a lot of people end up getting two, so you have an offsite one. So back your computer up twice, and then take one of the drives to work.
Yep.
So that it's not in your house in case of a fire, flood, theft, things like that.
Or get one of those fire safe boxes.
Get a fire safe,
You know, again, there's another Christmas gift idea.
Because you probably have important papers at home that should be in a fire safe.
And here's the thing. I always tell folks, you know, they'll put it up in the attic. Don't put things up in the attic. If you can, put it in the basement. Fire goes up. It doesn't go down.
And the fire department chops holes in your roof to get the water in.
Right. And the safest place for something to be would be downstairs in a basement. You know, up on a shelf because, you know, again, it's cooler down there. And fire will travel up. Usually most fires don't start in a basement. They usually start on the first floor or the second floor. Yep. And the chances of the box really getting a lot of heat and melted down are less.
And you don't want it completely on the basement floor in case of a flood.
Right. You put it up on a shelf or something else.
And you want to make sure you get a data-rated fire safe. Because most fire safes are only rated for papers. But you need a data-rated fire safe so that your hard drive, CD drive, you know, your magnetic media can withstand the heat and the flooding. Some safes aren't rated for flooding, which often happens in a fire.
So, yeah.
With all the water being poured in your house. Yeah. And so you can search safe companies for different ratings on how long it will sustain fire, how long it will sustain submerged. And in fact, we have one of the biggest safe companies in town here, Century Safe, and they have a lot of data-ready fire safes. They even have fire safes with a hard drive built into the safe, and there's just a USB port. So you plug the USB cord into your safe, and the hard drive is already in the safe.
Nothing wrong with that. You know, it's probably well insulated and everything else.
Yep.
So, you know, again, that's another good Christmas idea. And something, you know, again, if it's that important to you, that you would be totally upset because, excuse me, to get that data back can sometimes cost you hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars.
Yeah, most of the commercial data recovery services, Drive Savers, OnTrack, you're looking at $1,000 minimum.
You know, and that's one other thing that gets me, and I know you run into it in your business too. You know, we'll take the time and effort to get people's data back, and you tell them what it's going to cost. And they go, what?
Yeah.
Why? Well, you know what? If you had it backed up, it wouldn't be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a lot of time and labor intense
yeah.
intensity to get that stuff back.
Especially,
and if you go off to a professional site, like you said, it's going to be hundreds or thousands of dollars. And sometimes that's just for them to look at it, and they can't always guarantee the data integrity.
They especially Drive Savers, they have their Museum of Disasters.
Yes.
A river boat that sank, and they sent a scuba diver down to get the computer. But basically, what we joke about is they have a clean room and spacesuits and an electron microscope, and they take the drive apart and they look at every little bit of rust on the drive,
mm-hmm.
because basically magnetic particles, and are
That's
they going up and down to be north south, or are they going down and up to be south north?
Mm-hmm.
And so a terabyte hard drive has a trillion bytes on it. Well, it's 8 bits per byte. Let's call it 10 to make the math easy.
Yep.
10 trillion little bits of magnetic particles they have to look at. And they can never guarantee what files they're going to get back because they don't know where on the disk those files are.
Exactly. And, you know, so folks, when we are able, and we've had a pretty good success rate with our business getting stuff back.
I've got a drive at the office now that's been running for 2 or 3 weeks on a scanning program. 90% of the blocks are bad.
Oh.
It just comes up unrecoverable error. That drive is probably gone.
And, you know, the other thing is, because a lot of this, you know, we'll do an upfront charge because we know it's going to be that intent.
Yep.
And then folks get upset. Well, you didn't get any of my data back. Why should, you know, I should get all my money back. No. We spent time and effort. It's a gamble.
The service is the time it takes.
Yeah. Hello. It's a gamble. Just like you pay insurance and everything else. You're hoping against, disasters. Well, in this case, you're hoping that we can get it back. There are no guarantees. Yep. The only guarantee you would have is if you took the time and effort to back it up yourself.
We had a customer once that had bought a backup hard drive and never got around to backing up. That tends to be pretty common. But this one customer, she had sat down, took all the stuff out of the box and was reading the instructions, and her hard drive failed. If she'd have just skipped the instructions and ran the backup, she would have been okay.
Or you
who reads instructions?
Or you'll get the ones, you know, how they put that other in storage. They'll take a drive and they'll take a partition for the factory restore.
Yeah, I remember restoring to D. Yeah,
and they'll put their files there. And then the hard drive goes totally south. You know, like you said, 90% you can't get it back. But I backed it up. Where? Well, there was a letter D there.
Yep.
And there was a lot of space there. So I used that to put the files. Sorry, it's gone.
I actually had a computer a couple weeks ago that happened to. The primary partition failed with disk I/O errors and bad blocks, but the recovery partition was fine. So it would still boot the recovery partition, but it couldn't do anything to the main partition.
Yep, yeah.
Which is uncommon, but
it still happens.
Yep.
You know, I mean, you folks, if it's that important to you, then you got to take the time to do it.
And then there's commercial backup services that will back up over the internet. Carbonite, CrashPlan, we've talked about a few of them. Yep. CrashPlan has an interesting option where you can share a buddy's hard drive. And so he can say 10 gigabytes of the hard drive. Excuse me, is accessible. And you can say 10 gigabytes of my hard drive. And you back up each other's stuff. And so one of the concerns with a cloud-based backup is you have to trust the people in the cloud to not look at your data. Most of them will encrypt the data before they send it up to the cloud. But it's kind of a neat idea. You have a buddy you trust, and you back up your files to their computer. Or, you know, just for that $100-ish, you get your own backup hard drive and then take it to the buddy's house and have him put it in his fire safe.
Yeah, or like there's also the Google Drive.
Google Drive,
I mean, there's 5 gig for
five
free.
5 gigs, yeah, that's a lot of documents.
Yeah.
Yeah, Google Drive is relatively inexpensive for adding space. Most of the services, Dropbox and Mosey and whatnot.
But the nice thing I love about Google Drive, one, it's a backup, plus the flexibility of grabbing documents no matter where I am. If I've got, like we've
on
talked about before.
On your computer or your mobile device.
My tablet or my phone. I can get to the Google Drive and get to anything that's important to me.
Yep.
You know, and that's critical.
My SkyDrive, I had a Microsoft account so long ago that I got 25 gigabytes free on my SkyDrive. Right now, they're only offering SkyDrive was 7 gigabytes for free. So there's a program, I can't remember the name of it now, that aggregates all of the free services. So you get 5 gigs free at Google, you get 2 gigs free at Dropbox, you get 7 gigs free at Microsoft. They'll aggregate all those free services together and give you a single drive that's 50 gigabytes, which is pretty cool.
That's a good way to do it.
Yep.
What else we have there in other questions?
Yeah, this goes back to something we were talking about earlier. Gerd writes in that he's having a problem. How does he remove his Facebook account if he doesn't remember his Facebook password? Well, you go through the forgot my password functions and see if you can remember what your password questions were.
Yeah, if you can do that, then you can go ahead and...
Yeah, but a lot of people just stop using Facebook and just don't post to it anymore. But if you actually want to delete your Facebook account, you do have to log in and then go to, I forget exactly where it is, somewhere in settings or preferences, you can delete your account. But then what Facebook does is kind of interesting. They don't actually delete your account for a few days, I think maybe a week or so. So you can change your mind and undelete your account, which is kind of handy. But then the problem that a lot of websites have found is that they don't actually delete your data, especially your photos.
Yeah.
That if someone saved a link to a photo in your Facebook account... Or you've been tagged. If you delete the photo yourself, that photo still exists in the Facebook system, and other people can still get to it if they know the URL.
So, yeah, there's a lot of links, and that's the whole trouble. Once you put stuff up on the internet... I don't think you can truly and honestly remove it totally.
Nope.
It's just
pretty much gone. No hope of removing it. Alrighty, that music tells us we're going to take another short break, hear from some of our wonderful underwriters.
Yeah, and Roger, hold on. We'll have you on right after this.
All right, and so you're listening to Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
And welcome back to this edition of Sound Bites. I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And we have Roger on the phone. Go ahead, Roger.
Hi. I've got a Compaq with Windows Vista. And I periodically get messages to back up my my computer. And so I tried this recently, and... backing up to the DVD drive, after about an hour to 2 hours, and I got up to disk 11, I wondered whether everything was really working there. And so I wanted to check with you folks and see just whether, you know, things make sense here.
How big is your main hard drive?
Okay, my C drive is 286 gigabytes, of which it says 204 is free.
So that's
80 gigs
used.
82 that I'm actually using.
So a typical DVD is 4 gigabytes. So you would need 20 DVDs to back up 80 gigabytes of data, which is why we recommend hard drives are so much better to back up to, because a small hard drive is 1,000 gigabytes. So it used to be you could back up the floppies when that was one meg, and then when it started taking 10 or 20 or 30 floppies, then you moved up to CD. I remember Microsoft Office version 4 came on 67 floppy disks, and it would always be the case that you get to disk 62 and it failed.
Always, or even worse yet, you'd get into say disk 58.
Yep.
So close.
Yep. So then that's when they started coming out on CDs. Well, CDs were 700 megs, so that was 700 floppy disks. That was a lot of space. And then DVDs came out at 4 gigabytes. That's a huge amount of space until we have 100 gigabyte drives.
Okay, let me throw this into the mix. My previous computer, the motherboard failed back at the end of last year. I got the new computer, and I took the old computer into Dave, and you copied my files onto an external hard drive, and that's hooked up now. It's got a capacity of 298 gigs, of which it says that I'm only using 288. So I could back up to that then? my 82 gigs that I'm looking
Probably, yeah. There's also different backup programs that will do what's called archiving. So some backup programs,
they crunch it.
They'll delete your old backup. So say you're backing up on Wednesday. That will delete Monday's backup and put Tuesday's back on it. Some of the backup programs will keep Monday's backup and Tuesday's backup and Wednesday's backup. So it archives a history of your backups. Those types of programs are usually a little better because they let you go back in time and keep older files, but they do take up more disk space. So it depends on what backup program you're using as to what kind of thing it will do.
And do you still need all that other information that we backed up for you on that other drive?
Yeah, you never know what you might need.
Well, if they're programmed, you can get rid of
a couple times to look at some old basically email files or things like that.
As Dave is mentioning, there's two different kinds of backup strategies. One is to back up your entire computer, including the operating system and the applications, and that takes up more backup disk. Mm-hmm. And the other is to just back up your documents, the My Documents folder.
Documents, pictures, emails, and that type of stuff.
So that takes up less backup space.
How do I back up just the documents?
It depends on what backup program you're using.
Right.
In the settings of that program, it will ask you what do you want to back up from and then where you want to back it up to.
Okay.
So Windows Backup has its own settings built into it. There's also a Cobian backup that we talk about
a lot. I wouldn't rely on Microsoft's backup.
Windows Backup works pretty good, but Windows Restore doesn't work very well.
Cobian.
Spell it, please.
Cobian, is it?
I think so. We have a link on our
link. Yeah, we've
list.
Got a link on our website. If you go to soundbites.org, and you can go to click on I Heard It Here on the Show. And we have a lot of lists, you know, links to the various stuff that we talk about week after week here on the show.
Yep, Cobian.
Very good.
At cobiansoft.com. And then on the Mac, there's the Time Machine program that's built into the operating system to back up your files. And then a lot of people like a program called Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner that make an identical cloned copy of your hard drive as well. That's usually bigger in the IT crowd, where you can either have a fast backup or a fast restore. You generally can't have both. And so in IT and corporate stuff, they want a fast restore. So they just clone the entire hard drive so you can do a fast restore back. But then that's harder to maintain than a regular file backup.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
And there's something to be said about if you have to restore your files, installing a clean operating system, installing clean applications is often better. But just the time involved in doing that, needing to do your OS disk, Windows or Mac, and then you have to do all the updates to the OS, and then you have to do all your applications again, and then all the updates to the applications. So that becomes tedious in the event of a full hard drive failure.
Yeah.
So that's what makes a clone to backup nice. So most of the programs will do an incremental clone, where it will add
Ghost,
the changed files.
I still love Ghost. That's a good one.
Yeah, but that's commercial for Windows, which is a little annoying.
Yeah.
And it's commercial. What's it, like $800, something like that? I'm going to look it up.
Yeah.
So, Super Duper on the Mac is free. Carbon Copy Cloner, I think, is $30.
Yeah.
So it's what we used to call shareware, but it's now independent publishers. It's significantly cheaper because you're paying the guy directly. You're not paying a big company.
Exactly. All right, tell you what, let's go back to the phones, and we got Jim from Fairport. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling to see if you have any insider secrets for setting up a Frontier DSL connection. My DSL was out for a couple days this past week while they were working on their DSLAM. I think they were doing an upgrade because last week my father-in-law Fairport, the other side, was out, had his DSL out for a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, when I walked through, before I figured out that it was, before they told me it was their issue, common cause, they said, I had reset my DSL modem to the defaults, and it didn't work. And I followed the instructions they said, set it up for a PPPoE connection with a username and password, and that didn't work. And then I bought another DSL modem thinking that maybe my modem went bad, and that didn't work either. So they restored servers, but mine still didn't work using the instructions that they gave me. And finally, a Frontier guy came out to my house and dropped off a modem that they supported. They wouldn't look at the modems I had. And when I look in there, it's set up as a routed bridge. So what they dropped off isn't set up the way they told me to do mine. I wonder if you knew anything about this, and my other modems is no option for routed bridge, or even what that means. Why would they tell me do PPPoE when they're not using that, or what's the best way to get my modems up?
So what modem do you still have from theirs? Both of them? Old and new?
I have an Action Tech that was working until I had the outage. It's an Action Tech GT.
And that was going into what, a Linksys?
It goes right into the wall.
Yeah, see, this is what's happening in the Time Warner community now, that you can buy your own router, and then it's your responsibility to set everything up with DSL or cable, or you can pay the $5 or $6 a month and have them put their modem router in, and then they set everything up themselves. For a lot of people, especially the novice users, you're better off paying the small fee, because then they'll...
Right, and in case something happens to it, too, you know, they'll replace it. If it gets browned out or, you know, blows up on you, they'll replace it.
But I've seen some Frontier setups that use PPPoE. Some use straight DHCP. And it's very confusing sometimes to get your router set up right. If you're using a static IP address, that's even worse. And if your router isn't one of their supported brands, then they don't help you.
Right.
Oftentimes what you can do is go to the website of that company that makes your router.
But he can't get on.
On another computer.
I can get on and do that part.
Yeah, so what brand router did you say you had?
I went to Best Buy, and their most expensive one was $120. It's a Netgear 600.
Yeah, Netgear's a pretty decent brand. So, yeah, you go to the Netgear website and say, is anyone able to set up Frontier DSL with this model router? And quite often you'll find something that people that have already had that problem and solved it, or at least if you're the first one with that problem, you might find people that can help you solve it too. But it's difficult because the tech support at the ISPs it's not that they don't want to help you, it's they'd rather rent you the modem.
Right.
Yeah, I don't want to use their modem because, first of all, every tech I spoke to had my username in plain sight and read my password to me over the phone, and that's my main email password. So, you know, at any time, those are all plain text, someone can go in my email.
That's the first thing they've changed.
When they gave it to me, it had no firewall set up. The firewall was disabled, so that's probably not good. And then this kind of modem they give out, I see other people report that it's got some kind of middleware in there that does a man-in-middle attack and actually hacks your network to modify its gateway. If you Google Verizon DSL hack my computer, you'll see the details, but it's pretty amazing. I'd rather have my own equipment.
We've seen that a lot on some of the newer Cisco routers with their new Cisco OS on it, that as part of their network management facility, they can, in essence, see every website you're going to and
well, they know where you are.
The point is to monetize it, but they can inject ads into websites you go to, and a lot of people really hate that. But just in general, your ISP can see any website you go to anyway because they have to route the traffic. But having your password exposed is really annoying, and not being able to separate your PPPoE password from your email password is especially frustrating as well.
Yeah, I didn't know until I looked up this modem router that by installing themselves as a gateway through these, I didn't realize DHCP wasn't secure. I thought I was pretty reasonably computer savvy, but I didn't realize that that can be used to do with this man-in-the-middle attack, and so that your ISP can actually look inside your network to see what's going on, because all your internal computers can be routed to go through the modem, which they have exposure to. So it's pretty scary.
Yeah, that's basically how the internet works. Is the person upstream from you that you get your internet service from? They can see anything you're doing.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. These modem routers actually send out a man-in-the-middle DHCP attack. So if you have a subnet which is entirely internal to your LAN, this particular router, the modem router that they're giving out, will reprogram the DHCP into that subnet and route it through themselves, even though it's internal to your LAN. So it's a it's a little different. I understand what you're saying. Of course, anyone can, you know, once you're out of your land, everything you send is clear, but this is even a step beyond that.
So, well, that's interesting, because if you have like a 192 private address, that's not routable. That's the point of private addresses. It cannot be routed.
Right, but what happens is it sends out some kind of a NAC. You know, this might be boring to the rest of your listeners. I apologize, but it sends out like a NAC, DHCP NAC, and then ACK, and then an address right of way. So if you have a program, a computer on your private LAN, which has DHCP to somewhere in your network, this actually will reprogram the DHCP through the modem router, which can be, you know.
Well, because
which is outside of that subnet.
Because that's your DHCP server, That's fairly normal, because your router generally acts as your DHCP server, so that all of the...
To hand out the
addresses. All the computers on your LAN are asking that router for an address, and they pass along their MAC address, and the DHCP server assigns an IP address to that MAC address.
Yeah, but it shouldn't go into subnets. It should only be on the subnet. It's, you know,
it shouldn't cross subnets.
Me, so,
right.
Unless
I must misunderstand.
So their router must be.
That's a great tip. I'll go to the Netgear website, and someone there must be charged with supporting the threat.
Sure. Yep. I suppose it's possible they're crossing subnets in their DHCP tables.
Yeah, they could. Yeah.
So, and that's
interesting.
One thing people might like to buy their own router is that you can have more control over it and set up what it does.
The security
But then you have to know how to do it, and that's difficult. One of the biggest...
That's where you and I come in hand, that we can come out there and securely, you know, set this all up for you and make sure it is locked down.
Well, that's a great idea, because I think there's a lot of things that you guys could do on a visit, like disable SSID broadcasts on your Wi-Fi and disable DHCP.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you guys could probably make a living just doing on-site security.
Oh, we do.
I recommend people do that.
It's the security versus convenience. DHCP is very convenient. Setting up static IP addresses and manual routing tables is very tedious. But that's the trade-off of security versus convenience.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. So thanks again, guys. And again, I absolutely recommend that folks contact you to get their home networks secured in lockdown.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yep. One of the biggest mistakes we happen to see is people leave their router at the default password. So everybody knows that the Linksys password is admin, and the default Netgear password and the default Belkin password. So the first thing you should do when you buy your own router is change that default password, so that other people can't, you know, drive by your house and log into your system. Alrighty. Sounds like this is going to be our last break of the show. Coming up on 20 minutes to 2 here on Soundbites. Give us a call, 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or you can also go on the website, jazz901.org. And we will be right back after these short messages from our underwriters.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Sound Bites here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1. I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And let's see.
So we should mention a little bit, we talked about that last call. Cisco, which is one of the largest router companies, and they own the Linksys brand, they own the Ubi brand that a lot of cable and DSL companies use. They had a firmware update in their Linksys EA series of routers, and they have a new service called Cisco Cloud Connect, or Cisco Connect Cloud. And the service is supposed to be a way to make it easy for you to manage your router. You can manage your router from a smartphone, from a tablet, from another computer. But that means that your router's administration services are available to the public internet. And that's one of the biggest things we say to turn off is turn off the configure over WAN or advertise over WAN or allow WAN connection. The wide area network is the public internet. So if you want to configure your router when you're not at home with your router, the danger there is that anyone could theoretically get into your router.
Mm-hmm.
They would need the password. But
most folks don't even know how to go in.
Right. They don't change the default password, so it's easy to get into. So Cisco apologized for the problem and told people how to roll back their firmware. But they're still offering the service available, and it's likely that most of their newer routers have this Cloud Connect service set up. So it's basically a Java app that you run on your computer or an app that you download to your Android phone or iOS phone. It lets you manage your router, so you can change your password, you can change your SSID. I don't see any need to change any of that configuration on your mobile device. Do it on the computer, unless all you have is an Android tablet, and that's your only device in your house,
which is not
likely.
Yeah, no, and again, that's where we also offer a service where we'll come out and check and modify if we have to make sure that your network is secured and locked down so that the neighbors next door aren't tapping into your network and downloading stuff that, oh, by the way, you could get blamed for.
Yeah, there have been a lot of cases where the police have arrested, raided and confiscated computers because that was the end of the line.
Yep, and, guilt by, that ignorance is not an excuse.
Yeah, the one case I remember reading about, the guy was lucky that they didn't find anything on his computers because he wasn't doing it.
Right.
And he had noticed a suspicious-looking car that was parked in the street and wrote down the license plate number.
Yep.
But the police raided his house, took all his computers.
But you could have a neighborhood kid.
Yeah.
Computer savvy. You're just going ahead thinking, oh, well, yeah, I got internet and it's wireless and my kids and everybody else can, tap into it.
Yep.
That signal also goes out quite a ways. And if you don't take the time and effort to lock it down, a lot of stuff could come through that you might not want.
Especially now that a lot of the ISPs are implementing this 7-strike rule that's been bandied about. The Motion Picture Association of America has been pushing it. It started out as a 3-strike law. If you were accused 3 times of pirating a movie or pirating music, mm-hmm. the internet provider would cut you off for life. 3 was a little drastic, so now they're saying 7-strike rule. And the real big danger of that is there's no trial, basically.
Okay.
Someone can accuse you of being a pirate, and that counts as a strike.
All right, so guilty.
Guilty until proven innocent, yeah. And so if you get too many strikes, then your internet service gets cut off and you're blacklisted from subscribing to the internet again. And how are they calculating these strikes? So are you going on Pirate Bay and downloading Spider-Man? Okay, that's probably illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going on Google Cloud Drive and downloading the copy of Spider-Man I put there?
Mm-hmm.
That's not illegal.
Yeah.
So, how is the ISPs supposedly are going to have a grievance policy. So when you get a strike, you can respond to the strike and say, that wasn't a piracy. But that's partly why the 7 strikes are being augmented to. Some ISPs are doing 6 strikes, some are doing 7. So it's not such a quick disconnection.
Okay.
But it's very annoying and very frustrating for average people who don't quite understand what they're doing. And how are you going to differentiate between streaming on Netflix
mm-hmm.
versus streaming on BitTorrent?
True.
Different protocols. So
yeah.
so the ISPs haven't wanted to do this
mm-hmm.
because that's extra work for them. They have to have extra management tools in their network to differentiate different protocols. But say it's a web protocol. I don't know. Does Netflix use HTTP streaming and does BitTorrent use HTTP streaming? So it looks exactly alike to both of them.
Huh.
So how are they going to do that?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. Everything is, was in most people's thinking, it's supposed to make life simpler. In a lot of cases, it's just made things more complicated.
Yeah.
because, you know, you just want to use it for this and that. And now there's all these other precautions that you have to take to be a safe surfer.
And for the most part, most people are fairly honest. You're always going to find that criminal element, but most people are honest. I missed a TV show last week. Well, can I get it on demand? Can I get it on Netflix? Can I get it on Hulu? You know, can I get it on iTunes? Where do I get this thing that I missed? You know, I don't want to wait a year to buy the DVDs, so it's very frustrating. In fact, some people are using that justification. I'll pirate it now because I know I'm going to buy the DVD when the whole set comes out.
I got to admit, I have gotten to where I don't watch most regular TV.
Yep.
I'd rather watch it, you know, on demand.
Yeah.
Because one, you can take a show that's, say, normally an hour, and it'll be down to about 45 minutes.
Not always. Fox on demand, you can't fast forward through the commercials.
Oh, yeah. No, you can't fast forward. But the thing that is, though, is usually the TV program itself is cut down from an hour to, you know, at least a minimum of 50 minutes.
Yep.
Most of the time, it's like 45. And even with a few brief commercials in, and you can tell on some of them, depending on what I'm watching, you can see where it's going to go to a break, and then it quick comes right back.
Yeah.
It doesn't really take a break. So I get to see
You'll get the national program. Yeah, you might get the national ads, but you may not get the local ads.
Yeah, so I'm watching more with less.
Yep. And I've almost gotten into the habit now. We watch so much stuff on our DVR that when I happen to be watching live television, I'll grab the remote and hit fast forward, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
In fact, sometimes we'll wait 10 minutes before we start watching a show so we can skip through the commercials.
Yeah.
Now, I will watch commercials. So I'm not trying to, you know, there was that big thing a few years ago, but NBC trying to sue the general public because it's your legal obligation to watch commercials because you're getting television for free. I don't mind watching commercials, but I don't want to see the same commercial again and again. And that's the big thing about on-demand is like the same two commercials will run every single time.
Yes. And then, those stupid icons down the bottom of the screen identifying the TV program. Or the station. Yep. I know what station I'm on. I don't need that in my
face. Well, that's a big thing, that station branding. Most people don't know what station they're on. I just want to watch Dexter, or I just want to watch CSI. I don't care what channel it's on. I might know the channel number, but I don't know the network name. And so all the networks are having to brand themselves because of competition from cable networks and now from internet streaming. I go to Hulu and watch something. I don't know what network it was originally on. Yeah, I go to Netflix.
8, 10, and 13, you don't know the national ones? Maybe you should.
Well, especially since 8 and 10 switched here in Rochester. I don't remember which network is which anymore. At least 13 is still just the same network. But yeah, so the network branding is a big thing. Mm-hmm. And what's weird is sometimes a show, there's been a new trend lately that shows will have a fall finale. So typically on a TV show, there's 22 to 26 episodes. And a lot of shows are now doing like 10 or 13 episodes and then going on hiatus for 6 months. And we're seeing more like other shows coming in. So they'll have a fall finale. In fact, we're watching the fall finale of Grimm. The show goes on hiatus. And then you start seeing people from that show in other shows. And that usually meant the first show was canceled because people don't cross shows anymore. If you're on a different show, then your first show has been canceled. Well, but we're seeing so many
series aren't on for the whole year anymore. They're only on for like Fallen Skies. It's only from January on or this one. They're only on for half a season.
Yeah. And then they'll go on hiatus and come back for the other half of the season. So they have a fall finale now instead of a series finale. But then what we're seeing is a lot of production studios are making shows that they sell to different networks. And you'll often see directors and producers will have actors they like. And so the same actor will show up on different networks because it's the same production company. And that used to be a huge no-no, is that an actor couldn't go to another network show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Back when there were only three networks.
Yeah, it's goofy the way it's gone. But, but going back, though, that's, like I say, one thing I do like is the on-demand. That's one feature I've been able to watch more because I don't watch a lot of TV. I've gotten to where I do, you know, a lot more reading and that type of stuff for the time of the head. I just find that a little more relaxing. But there are a few that I like to catch once in a while. And it's nice just being able to go at any time, day or night, depending on my schedule, yep, to sit down, pull that one up and say, oh, yeah, I want to get caught up on this one and do it. And it could be, you know, a couple weeks later.
Yeah, and then sort of one of the problems with on-demand is it only goes back two or three or four episodes sometimes. Yeah. So if you miss two or three too many, so then you got to go to Netflix or Hulu. Mm-hmm. One of the I use TV.com is a nice website for finding information about TV shows and what actors were in what, and they do a little trivia thing about what was going on in the show. For each episode, they list all of the online services. So where can you watch this online? You know, Amazon or iTunes or Hulu, and if it's free or if you have to pay for it, or directly on the network. So sometimes you can go to the network and watch it for free, but not often. Oops, there we go. Not often the same week.
Yep. Well, you know what? That kind of wraps it up here for us, folks. You've, as Nick would say, wasted a whole 2 hours on your life. But, you know, we really appreciate you taking the time and effort to tune us in. And George from the German Show is up next for some really great German music. Definitely stay tuned in with him. Upcoming next here at Member Supported Jazz 90.1.